You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Tokaj.
Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Where are we today, Lionel?
We're still in Hungary, Richard. We're in Tokaj. Sounds very like the Scottish word.
Tokaj the new.
I can see how this episode's gonna go.
I mean, it was obvious a mile off, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, we've gone from Gudulu to Tokaj, and well, this is just completely off the track. As far as I'm concerned, this is
Napalm. Did you enjoy the lovely short transfer we had last night? We finished the stage in Budapest. Another night in Budapest. Lovely dinner last night. Short drive to the start. I mean, this Giro is designed beautifully.
Long stage though, isn't it? A lot of driving today. But, you know, can't have everything.
Perry, yeah, through some of the most beautiful, you know, one of the most beautiful regions of Hungary, or indeed Eastern Europe, you know, through the vineyards of Eger to Tokaj. You've always wanted to go there, world famous for its sweet wine.
Yeah, I'm looking out of my window here as that doesn't all rush past, but no, excellent. No, a great stage.
Come on, Lionel, a bit of imagination, the vineyards of Hungary to the fields of Watford. It's not too much of a leap, is it?
Maybe I should be printing out these vistas and sticking them on my office wall so I've got some authentic scenery to look at as we record.
What do we have coming up in today's episode? Well, it's a special one, really, because, well, they're all special, obviously, but we're doing something a little bit different today. We're revisiting a classic film, Stars and Water Carriers, which followed the 1973 Giro d'Italia. Quite a noteworthy Giro for several reasons, but one of the main reasons was because the Danish filmmaker Jorgen Lett was there filming it, making a documentary about it, and it's a fascinating film. We have an interview with Jorgen, who's a fascinating character, in this episode. Before we go to the tale of the Tapa, I should also say that we've ventured into film ourselves, and from today, that's Monday, you can get, if you're a friend of the podcast, you can watch our first film. It's called And So We Rode, and it follows Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass on their great adventure from a couple of years ago when their team went bust in the middle of the season and they took off into the Alps. So using some footage from the ride and interviews with the pair of them, we've put together a 40-minute film, and it's available free for friends of the podcast. You'll be emailed about that. And if you sign up in the next month as a friend of the podcast, you can watch the film. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. More information on that in the show notes, but can you give us the tale of the Tapa, please, Lionel?
I can indeed. Well, Daniel, being the contrarian he is, has taken our Giro in completely the opposite direction to the way Mauro Venier was hoping to take the real thing. We should have been travelling southwest towards Croatia. Instead, Daniel has turned us around in the road and we're going up towards the Slovakian border to Tokaj, underneath the brow of Hungary's biggest mountain, Kekus.
Did you notice this will be the first episode of our Giro in which we don't hear from Mauro Venier. That's because we've fallen out. We've gone our separate ways. He's headed southwest and we're going northeast.
Why have we headed in this direction? This is wine country, isn't it, Daniel? This is your other great passion. I'm not saying cycling is one of your other great passions, but this is one of your great passions.
Yes, it is, Lionel. As I said, we're going to Tokaj, a very small town actually, but it's world famous, particularly for its sweet wine. I'm not going to try to educate Richard on the intricacies of sweet wine making and noble rot and detritus
and botrytis. Sweet wine.
No, Richard, no, it doesn't. I was curious there, Napalm, you mentioned the highest mountain in Hungary, Kekus. Question for Richard, is it higher or lower than Ben Nevis?
Oh, it'll be higher.
It's not, it's lower. It's 1,000. I think it's 1,034 metres. And Ben Nevis is 1,300 and something, I think.
Well, wow. you mentioned the climbing. This is a relatively flat stage, but our Giro on the RGT platform has managed to simulate the only lump on the course today. So let's go over to the course and see how the elephant of Watford is getting on. Stage 3 of the Giro, our Giro. 38 kilometres, finishing near Tokaj, in the heart of Hungarian wine country. Daniele Fibrincini is channeling the spirit of Vincenzo Torriani, because if this is a flat stage, we're in for a very tough Giro.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
We are very grateful to our title sponsors, iWoka, an award-winning finance company that specialises in lending to small businesses. They've issued more than £1 billion to companies ranging from startups to established businesses. iWoka can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, and by making it quick and easy to apply for a loan and get a quick decision, it can be a more flexible option than approaching the big banks. iWoka are also very into cycling, sponsoring the Kendal Cycle Club based on the edge of the Lake District and the Cycling Podcast, of course. For more information on iWoka, go to iwoka.co.uk.
Amarcord, I remember.
It was an acquired taste, really. It took me a couple of mouthfuls to really get into it, but then once I got going...
But by your second plate, enjoying it.
A bit like pedalling a big gear. The first couple of revs were tricky, but then once I was up to speed, I was racing through my
dish. Should mention the meal we had the night before. Showing a shocking lack of imagination, we actually ate in the same place two nights in a row.
Well, there was a good reason for that,
there wasn't.
Struggled to find anywhere that was open last night, so we were in an American hotel restaurant, weren't we?
Yeah, and it was very nice, and we had local food there and local wine, which was very nice as well.
Yeah,
thanks very much to friends of the podcast if you've been signing up because I hadn't actually worked out the exchange rate at the point where I ordered the wine that was recommended to me.
Yeah, I mean, part of travelling to other countries is, you know, getting to grips with a little bit of the...
But there's that beautiful moment where you haven't got to grips with the exchange rate, and it's not like real money, it's
like
Monopoly money.
Yeah, but then
money.
When we did the sums, we worked out that was quite an eye-watering bottle of wine. It was very nice.
TheCyclingPodcast.com if you'd like to sign up as a friend of the podcast. Or that might be the last bottle of wine of the Giro, I think. Well, I should explain, we were in Jerusalem there for the 2018 Giro, the start of the Giro, you and I, Lionel.
Do we walk offer loans to podcasts having blown their budget within two stages, I wonder?
One stage.
Well, yeah, that might have come in handy.
Very unlike the Buffalo to just stampede in.
Well, the moment of realisation for me was when I looked at the food menu and realised that the all the dishes were about £2, and then looked at the wine menu and realised that the wine he'd ordered was £90.
Yeah, you thought at one point you thought the food must be impossibly cheap, like not 0.5 pence a dish. Yeah. But sadly, that wasn't the case, and it was a very, very nice bottle of wine.
Was it nice?
I would say it was nice. Yeah, it was nice. The waiter was very insistent that we order it. I do remember that. He was particularly keen that we sampled that bottle of wine. So anyway,
he'd heard some of your tasting notes from Giri of Yore, and he knew that this was a really discerning wine drinker.
If I remember correctly, Lionel, it was a red wine, wasn't it?
It was a red wine, yeah.
Vino del giorno. Cin cin.
So for the second wine of the cycling podcast, Our Giro, we've got the Jemrádek Syrah from the Corona Winery up in Eger. Traditionally known for a bull's blood wine, you know, this particular Syrah is really concentrated, warm, oriental spices almost permeate through with a sort of chocolate and plum tobacco aftertaste in the end. Certainly a little more sophisticated than the bull's blood of old, but definitely that big, luxurious red wine that's been aged in new oak, giving it that softer caramel feel. Enjoy.
So, chaps, that was our friend Greg Andrews at Divine Cellars. So we've got it in front of us, haven't we? The Jemrádek Syrah.
Hungarian pronunciation, please. There's an emergency.
What do you make of it? What first impressions, Rich?
Nice.
I'm glad I can't see your glass that you're drinking this out of looks like an absolute aberration. Napalm's doing well.
It's a crystal wine glass, Daniel.
Anyway, napalm thoughts? Is that taking you straight to the... Shiraz, are you?
Oh, that is nice. Eh?
Good example of
that. I'd say nice.
Good example of a Shiraz. You can see yourself drifting down the Rhone, can't you? The Northern Rhone. You could be in Hermitage or Saint-Joseph or somewhere like that. Rich is drinking it straight from the bottle. Medium bodied, bit of spice there, bit of tobacco. Typical Shiraz.
Very good, yeah. Red, 13.5%.
But it's a lovely accompaniment for a relaxing evening watching a cycling film, isn't it?
I should have added that our route today, our Giro route, would have taken sort of right past the front door of this vineyard, or this winery. So
let's get the film on, shall we, chaps?
This is Stars and Water Carriers, directed by the Danish filmmaker Jürgen Leth.
The 56th Giro d'Italia, the Tour of Italy. The cycle race which this year has been extended for the first time to a semi-tour of Europe. 3,746 kilometers in 20 days. The Tour of Italy starts in Belgium. This is the first time a cycle race has been routed through the Mont Blanc tunnel, 11 kilometers long. All other traffic has been suspended for an hour or so. At last, Il Giro is on home ground and emerges on the sunny side of the Alps. The field freewheels down into La Bella Italia. But this last-minute effort does not change the final results of the race. Number one, Max. Number two, Gimondi. Number three, Bataline. And further down the list, number seven, Ole Ritter. And number eight, Fuente. The race is over. He said goodbye to the team. Now he's on his own, ready for other races. A man with a cycle and a pocket full of contracts. A man with a cycle and his own ideas of what he will accomplish with his machine.
Well, we got there a flavour of Stars and Water Carriers, which we've just watched, which follows the 1973 Giro d'Italia from start to finish. It was an unusual Giro in that it started outside Italy, in Belgium. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But we're about to hear from Jürgen Leth, the director of that film. Now, Jürgen Leth is most famous in cycling circles for Sunday in Hell, his film from a few years later following Paris-Roubaix, but he made other films about cycling, The Impossible Hour, which followed Ole Ritter's attempt at the World Hour record. Ole Ritter was absolutely crucial to Stars and Water Carriers happening, a Danish rider and a great friend of Jürgen Leth. Leth made a film the year before Stars and Water Carriers called Eddie Merckx in the Vicinity of a Cup of Coffee. Have you seen that film, Daniel?
I have not. I'm not sure I was even aware of it before I heard.
It's a hard film to watch. We'll hear Leth mention it in this interview. It's quite a difficult film to get your hands on. It's not on YouTube, but it's an experimental film, as so many of his films are. One of the first sports films he made was called Motion Picture, which was about and not about the Danish tennis player Torben Ulrich. Leth is 82 now. He has for many years been a commentator on Danish television at the Tour de France, so he's been involved in cycling for many years, but he makes lots of other films as well. He's a poet, an artist, and a very interesting character. So let's hear from Jürgen Leth now.
The idea came about because Ole Ritter suggested it to me, simply, because he had just been recruited by Bianchi. He knew I was a filmmaker. I knew him well before that because I had a plan to do a film about him in the early 60s, and I admired him. He came to me and suggested that I simply come and follow him and the Bianchi team in that year's, in the 73 Giro. So that's how it came about.
And I understand it was quite last minute in terms of how it came together in the end.
Absolutely, and the trigger thing was that he said, if you come to the cinematographer to the race, I will take care, we will take care of you, meaning Bianchi team would host us. There would be no expenses on that. So that's an incredible part of the production that he took care of that way. And he said we would be very welcome. Under this lad, of course, the idea was that we were following him and the Bianchi team. But he didn't think of that commercially, but that clicked in a way, that we were there to film. And this was long before cycling became a commercial asset in the world of cinema and documentaries. Long before.
Going there, you know, shooting a film of a three-week race, what did you want to achieve? What did you want to convey through the film?
I was interested in the inner qualities of athletes and cycling. I was fascinated by cycling. I had followed cycling some years already. I had been cycling myself as an amateur in Aarhus. I liked it very much. I was fascinated by the mythos of cycling immediately, more than the technical things. I've always been more interested in the mythology more than the technical things. But so that was what brought me to it. And that was also what was the background of the style that I used to tell the story about one bicycle rider in a team, in a big race. That's what it's about. One bike rider, not necessarily the biggest star of all, but one bike rider that I could identify with inside a team, being part of a favorite in a big stage race. That was the whole idea. And I knew that I would tell some stories that are different than others because I was interested in the mythology, in the poetry of the race, and nobody else was. So I knew I had other stories to tell than the journalists. That was clear. And that has been clear for me always.
What's interesting watching it now is, you know, an obvious thing, but there are no interviews. Was that something you ever considered, you know, including interviews as well as the narration?
Of course, I was, I was an ambitious filmmaker. I was a director with an artistic sense of what I wanted to tell and which way I wanted to tell it. So I immediately rejected the idea of making an interview film. I'm not interested in that. And you can see that in my later films also. I never do that. I never do normal, ordinary documentaries. I'm trying to renew documentary genre always. I always have a different grasp on it. I want to renew the storytelling when I enter the professional sport. So you can see that in all my sports films. I'm always trying to take a poetic view of the sport, a poetic and mythological view of the sport. I had to tell the story my way and tell what I saw in the sport.
I mean, I say there are no interviews, but there are interviews, very unusual and very revealing interviews conducted by a couple of the riders on the move with the microphone in the middle of the peloton.
Yeah, that's a coup, I think.
I'm sure, I don't know what you expected from it, but it's incredibly revealing of Merckx in particular and how he related to the other riders. Yeah, yeah.
It's great fun to see that. But you know, that was an idea by Ole Ritter. I could never have imagined to be able to do that, never. I could never have dared to suggest that. It was Ole Ritter's idea. He said, that's possible, I can do that. You can give me a microphone and you can drive slowly. Dan Hollenberg, my cameraman, could drive slowly on the motorbike in front of him. That would be okay. So Ole Ritter was playing a very, very important role in the whole concept of this film. Never be possible any time later.
No.
Anywhere. It's an impossible thought.
Especially with the cord of the microphone sort of dangling among the bikes and the wheels.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And you know, also when you mention it, you know, what Ole Ritter contributed several things to the production. So in fact, he's the real life producer behind it. He made it possible in economic ways also. I mean, he didn't pay money, but he invited us. That's the first thing. He suggested the motorbike man, Sergio Penazzo, who is a friend of his. He hired him. And, I think we paid maybe his fee, but that was his idea. And then he lent me his car, 504, Peugeot 504.
Which is the car we see at the end.
And that's Ole Ritter's car.
And it's the car we see at the end, isn't it? With him loading his bike. Yeah,
that's Ole's car. So, you know, I mean, he's... In fact, he's the real producer of the film. He contributes more than the cost of all the rest. And we didn't have any fees or anything. We just did the film.
It's a Giro that was dominated by Eddie Merckx, obviously. But watching it, you get the strong sense that you're very drawn to Fuente, Jose Manuel Fuente. Your sympathies were with him, it seems.
Yes, I like Fuente very much. My hopes was with him. I always liked the attacker. Today I like Nairo Quintana more than anybody else. You know, I like the attacker. I like the offensive, the man who's a poet in the race, who's creating his own race. I like that. So naturally, here in this case, there was Eddie Merckx, who was a power, main power. And then there's the rebel. And of course, I sympathize with a rebel. That's natural for me to develop it that way.
Was Merckx, because he was so dominant, he features heavily in Sunday in Hell as well. Was he a gift or a curse to a filmmaker?
He didn't present any difficulties. I must admit that. He was very kind. He accepted we were there. He didn't know exactly what about my sympathy for Fuente, but he was he's outrageous in a way because he wants everything and at the same time. He wanted to dominate totally, that was clear. But he didn't resent us. He thought it was great to have a film. You remember, this was 73, there were no films about this sport at all. Only the year before there was Joël Saint-Denis who did La Course en Tête.
I'm just thinking, I mean, nowadays it's so complicated working with, you know, ASO, RCS and so on. Were there any barriers in your way back then or did Ritter open all the doors for you? I mean, were there any negotiations that had to be had with the organisers?
No, not really. As I remember it, there was no problems. The most important thing is that we were adopted by Adorni, by the team, the Bianchi team. That has a great prestige in Italy, as you can imagine, with Felice Di Mondi as their favorite. So I think that opened all the doors that they accepted us. It's due to Ole Ritter's influence directly. I mean, Ole Ritter was highly respected, and this is proof of it. He was highly respected for his talent as a rider, his loyalty, and basically everybody was interested in having a film made about the race or the team. So that opened all the doors. I met Tor Jani, but I never discussed with him anything. No details at all. It's amazing compared to the situation today. We had no problems at all. No problem, no discussions, no contracts or anything.
It was quite an unusual Giro in starting abroad, wasn't it? That Giro began in Belgium, obviously, and it was a sort of celebration of the European project, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was early to do that. That has been more normal later years with the Tour de France. And also with you still. But this was first time, I think. I think so. I don't remember, but I think it was the first time that they started in another European country. Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, Fuente and Quintana. You've obviously kept your links with the sport and they've grown over the years. The sport's changed a lot, but has the essence of it changed? Have the riders changed?
I don't think so. I'm not so... I don't know. I think the sport is still great and still full of personalities. I don't see a dramatic difference, you know. I think they're still the same stories. Of course, I tend to see that the old races were maybe a bit more romantic in the view of the stars and the carriers and the water carriers. By the way, that title, the stars and the water carriers, came also from Ole Ritter. I never heard that word before. But since that film, it has been used always by everybody. But I never heard the word before Ole Ritter pronounced it when we were planning. I asked him once in an interview. I interviewed him many times in Danish press, and I did a book about him also. And I asked him, who are the riders? And he said, they're the water carriers. And he explained what water carriers were and how that word came together. Simply riders getting, and you see it directly in the film, seen with water carriers in the most concrete way you can see it.
That moment is Guarino Tozzello asks Merckx, why not give the rest of us a chance? And Merckx's reaction.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Merckx's reaction is great. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. Great moment.
It is a great moment.
It's important to credit Ole Ritter with his innovative way to produce these situations. That's fantastic, I think.
Yeah, and you're obviously still friends with him now, are you?
We have a yearly lunch in his home with some artists. He has a lot of friends who are artists, in fact, and he's okay. He's well to do, and he's at a nice house. He's still a big importer of cycling equipment, etc. He also has a house in Mallorca. I see him there too.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport, our longest running sponsors, and they are offering 25% off to you, the Cycling Podcast listeners, at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. I've taken delivery of a lot of Science and Sport products recently, and I'll mention them over the course of our Giro coverage. So we heard there the interview with Jorgen Lett about Stars and Water Carriers, a film that stands the test of time in the sense that I really thoroughly enjoyed watching it. I was interested to ask Jorgen what he was trying to do with it, because it's not conventional storytelling, I suppose. There are, as I mentioned, no interviews. It's organized in chapters. One of the most sort of standout moments for me, which we talked about there, was when mid-stage some of the riders began interviewing each other, and there's this incredibly revealing moment where one of the Italian riders grabs the microphone from another rider. The rider who grabs the microphone is Guerino Tosello, and he asks Eddie Merckx, why do you not give the rest of us a chance? And Merckx kind of laughs and tries to brush the question off, and Tosello is very persistent. He says, "Rispondi, rispondi." Merckx says, well, the translation of what he says is, "You can say what you like, I'm indifferent," which I guess, you know, I don't care. And Tosello at that is quite angry, it seems. It's a really, really interesting and quite revealing moment. It's a Giro that, as I mentioned, began in Belgium. Merckx was really dominant, so the sort of tension, the drama in the race might have been lacking, but we get, as I think, a sense as a viewer that the guy whose sympathy, who has Lett as a filmmaker's sympathy, is obviously Ole Ritter, who's one of the main subjects, but also Jose Manuel Fuente, the Spanish climber who keeps launching these sort of do or die attacks. And well, Lett said there that his heart was with Fuente. And you know, he's one of these, another of these interesting characters. But what did you two make of the film?
Well, firstly, Richard, I'd love to have seen the risk assessment form for those on the bike interviews, because the microphone cable is sort of draped around riders' shoulders and across them, and they're all rolling along in the road while these interviews are being conducted. I was also really interested listening to Jorgen talking about how the film came about through Ole Ritter. And the impression that he gave was that the film centred on him, and yet Ritter really only kind of appears halfway through, doesn't he? The observation that it's constructed in chapters is an interesting one, because I think I probably watched this film for the first time in the early 90s. I would have bought it on a video cassette, having seen an advert in Cycling Weekly. In a way, it's a kind of visual template for probably 25 years of the way that the sport of professional cycling was explained to an English-speaking public. You've got the team tactic dimension, you've got the athletic prowess dimension, you've got the bit about what the mechanics do, you've got the comparison between the bike doing the work and the rider fueling for the race, and it's a real stylized impression of the Giro d'Italia. And the things that really leapt out to me were the bit where they're riding through the Mont Blanc tunnel, 11 kilometers with only little dot lights on the ceiling.
Amazing.
The riders' union would be up in arms at that, for a start. The sense that cycling tactics really aren't that much different today than they were then. Eddie Merckx's Molteni team, you know, they're in everything, aren't they? They get a man in the brake. When Eddie Merckx is in a brake, he's got a teammate in there. There's bits where his teammates are riding on the front, setting the pace. I mean, basically they're riding like boring policemen, just as we see from Team Ineos in the Tour de France these days. And the section on the riders' salaries as well was really, really interesting. You know, hearing that a team budget was around £175,000, and that was roughly in line with what the British transfer record for a footballer was at the time. So it gives an impression that, you know, cycling even then was a kind of a poor sport in comparison to certainly football. And then lastly, the looks of Italy itself, you know, a beautiful country now, a beautiful country then. Some of the scenery looks like it could have been the background for scenes from The Godfather, and dusty gravel roads as well. A lot of the mountain passes looked very gravelly and dusty. And just thinking back to conversations I had with mechanics last year about whether the Grand Tour should go off the beaten track and seek out these gravelly roads as if it's some kind of invention. No, this is a sort of return to what the sport was all about sort of 40 odd years ago.
On the subject of money, briefly, Eddie Merckx was getting £1,000 a day to ride, apparently, and Roger de Vlaeminck was on 18. I'm sure Roger de Vlaeminck wasn't very happy about that.
I'm sure he was thrilled with that. Well, obviously, Rich, watching the film, my attention was kind of drawn to, well, Merckx and the image you get of him in that film. I think it's worth bearing in mind that 1973, although, you know, physically he might have been stronger in 69, 73 was pretty much the peak of his domination. Also in the sense that in 1973, of course, he skipped the Tour de France. It was never fully explained whether it was explicitly because the Tour de France had asked him to stay away, but he did stay away, and we think that was what had happened. And he rode the Giro, obviously, as the favourite. But you know, bearing in mind how dominant he was at that time, the way Fuente was riding, and his whole sort of demeanour and attitude, it becomes even more sort of beguiling. The previous year, the 1972 Giro, Fuente had come in and he'd said that he was going to put Merckx out of the time limit on the Stelvio, which was, you know, about as ridiculous a statement of intent as you could possibly imagine. And then, you know, they'd got into the mountains in the south of Italy, and Fuente had beaten him on Blockhaus and looked as though he might put up a decent challenge in that Giro. And then the next morning, I mean, this sort of sums up, we talk about riders being flaky now, the likes of, you know, sometimes we get upset that Quintana's not attacking on every mountain stage or others like him. Fuente, on one of the key mountain stages that year, he and his teammates went for ice cream about 5 minutes before the start of the stage, developed stomach problems early in the stage, and Merckx took 5 minutes out of him because basically they'd fancied a gelato before the stage. And that was
why not
understandable. And that was pretty typical of Fuente, really sort of defied logic, defied common sense by launching these or making these ridiculous, grandiose statements of what he was going to do to Merckx. I mean, when I wrote my book on Eddie Merckx, I interviewed Walter Goderfrum, and he talked about Fuente as one of the big sort of challenges that thrown down the gauntlet to Merckx. And he said, you know, they were all very flawed, whether it was Ocaña or de Vlaeminck. He said there were three riders who could potentially trouble Merckx in major tours. One was Pinjon, who is a big talent, but he's a bit crazy, or at least not very professional. Then you have Ocaña, who must have a great physical gift to do what he does, but he's always in the disco after criteriums. And then the third is Fuente, who's brilliant at climbing, but also at smoking heavy cigarettes and drinking cognac.
And taking amphetamines, apparently, as well, is another thing that he was famous for. He retired very young at 29, Fuente, and he died at 50 after kidney problems. But he also, I read in another book, that at the 73 Tour de France, I don't know if you've heard this story, Daniel, he demanded that no one talk to him for 7 days, and apparently managed to stick to that. He's a kind of one of these beguiling, compelling...
Sounds like one of Daniel's conditions.
sounds like Kirienka.
I mean, he's got these kind of these cheekbones and these, you know, sunken eyes and this kind of upright position on the bike. He's a real contrast to Merckx, who in the film is described as kind of just he's just threshing away at the front, it seems. You know, you mentioned his teammates, Daniel, but the impression you're left with is that Merckx is just this force of nature, just capable of, through sheer physical power, you know, riding people off his wheel.
On that, Rich, on the, so about 15 minutes into the film, we see Merckx really take Fuente to the cleaners at Monte Carpegna, which is this beautiful climb in the Marche, the sort of landscape that Napalm was describing earlier, you know, this beautiful sort of bucolic scene of rural Italy. But the next morning, so after that stage in L'Unità, which was a sort of communist newspaper in Italy, one of the famous journalists covering the race, Gino Sala, wrote that Merckx was a monster, who'd won the Giro before it started and should have been left at home.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that you feel watching the film, that the race itself, there was no sort of real suspense to it. And there was an attempt to conjure that up through focusing on Fuente and his doomed attacks. But that was the thing that was lacking. And yet, despite that, you know, the film isn't really the story of the race. The film is a peeling away of the layers around professional cycling. And I mentioned to Jorgen Lett in the interview that one of my favourite chapters is the time trial, where, and I think, you know, Finlay Pretzel, who directed the film Time Trial about David Miller a few years ago, I know he has really looked up to Jorgen Lett. And one of the opening sequences there, when we see the side-on view of David Miller in that film, seems to me very reminiscent of some of the footage of Ritter in that time trial. And you're just left, there's no narration, it kind of goes quiet. There's this kind of beautifully hypnotic soundscape. And it's very kind of mesmerizing to watch. And I really felt watching that, that it wasn't something that happened almost 50 years ago, which is kind of a very difficult thing for me to say, given that this was just a few days after I was born. That this actually happened. But
did the Giro Peloton stop then to honour your birthday, or did they forget?
No, it was just after. You know, that sequence, I thought, you know, there was, you know, it's a cliche, but man and machine in perfect harmony. Ritter on his time trial bike looked fantastic. And it's interesting what you say, Lionel, about the comparisons with football and the money. I think that probably says more about football and where it was at back then, because so much of it looks kind of so lo-fi, and the mechanics working around the back of a cheap hotel. Ritter himself packing up his car at the end of the Giro, putting his bike in the boot and driving off, which is a wonderful scene, I think. A wonderful kind of closure to the story that we've just been following. And as Lett said, that's the car that they used to travel around Italy. And the most, from a contemporary point of view, you know, knowing as we do how difficult it is in particular for film crews or even people with mobile phones to take visual footage of the Tour de France or the Giro, you know, it seemed incredibly uncomplicated. Just turn up with a very small film crew and make a film and get into the middle of the bunch. He didn't even have a single conversation with Vincenzo Toriani, who was this very formidable director for 46 years of the Giro. And it seems absolutely astounding to me that wasn't an issue, that there were no kind of obstacles in the way for him to go and make this film at the time.
Just on Fuente, you're left with the impression in the film that he's kind of the biggest rival, the biggest challenger, and it's just nothing quite works out for him. He's kind of trying everything. He's always in the wrong place. He's trying to catch up, or he's trying to gain time. It's only when I looked at the results and realised that he finished eighth, 26 minutes behind Merckx, and not even the first or second man on his own cast team. He was the third man in a GC from his own team. And that just made me think about my own kind of discovery of cycling and how the sort of doomed heroism of riders was often very, it's very photogenic, isn't it? It's very kind of, it's an easy way to, it's a shortcut to telling the story of stage racing. Often the dominance isn't the interesting story. It's the doomed heroism that really captures the imagination and keeps you coming back for more, really.
And Rich, just what you say there about the sort of lo-fi nature of professional cycling, it made me think, well, particularly that stage I mentioned, the Monte Carpegna stage, where Merckx just, like you said to Jürgen Lett, like a threshing machine, he just powers away from Fuente. And it's a beautiful scene, and it's an area of Italy which, you know, I've been there, and you don't really, it's kind of at the intersection of three regions, Emilia-Romagna, Le Marche and Tuscany, and you kind of feel as though you're in the middle of nowhere. But Marco, that was one of Marco Pantani's favourite training climbs. And I was talking to a colleague of ours, Peter Cossins, the other day about, you know, what it was that made Pantani so appealing to the Italians. And it, part of it was this sort of lo-fi image that he cultivated. And just on Carpegna, people used to ask him whether he used a heart rate monitor. And he would say that Carpegna, you know, I've got a quote here, Carpegna is all I need to know whether I'm going well. And same thing if he was asked about nutrition, isotonic, energy drinks. He said, all I need are the four fountains on my route, one of them at the bottom of Monte Carpegna. I've lost count the number of times I've climbed Carpegna in training. You'll say I'm a traditionalist, maybe you're right, always training on the same roads, the same ones that I use in races. For example, he never used to go on recce routes. He would always just ride roads like these, the Monte Carpegna, there are a few others. Monte Fumaiolo, which you guys will be riding on the in our Giro.
Let would have been drawn certainly to Pantani as well. A quote that I copied down from William Fotheringham's book on his film A Sunday in Hell. Let told William, I'm drawn to the tragic figures. I'm fascinated by the greatness of their acts, the non-rationality, the courage. I like blind courage. I like the madness. It's a quality in art and sport. And I mean, watching the film, I say it stands the test of time. What's really interesting as well is that it was the first of three feature-length documentary films made about cycling in 3 years. There were Stars and Water Carriers in 73, La Course en Tête in 74, which is really, again, focused on Merckx, and The Greatest Show on Earth in 75, which, again, is focused on the Giro. And once again, Fuente is quite central to that story. All really good, all quite different. La Course en Tête also quite experimental. The Greatest Show on Earth, far more conventional telling of the story of the race. But all of them available on YouTube and all very well worth watching. But it's interesting that, well, Stars and Water Carriers, I don't think the premise for that wasn't the fascination around Merckx, which does seem to have inspired a lot of these other projects. It was very much it was coincidental, really, that Merckx was riding and winning. But one of the notable things I mentioned about that Giro was that it started in Belgium and took quite a long time to get to Italy. And we're obviously still in our imaginations in Hungary, another overseas start. They've become very, very common now for the Giro, but I think 73 was the first real proper overseas start for the Giro, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. They'd started in 1965 in San Marino, which of course is surrounded by Italy, isn't it? And in 1966 in Monaco, which is just next door. And this was the first time that the race started, well, this far away from Italy. Well, approaching the mid-70s, it was a celebration of Europe coming together, wasn't it? And the race, well, it started in Verviers and went to Cologne in Germany and then into Luxembourg and then Strasbourg, then Geneva, and finally arriving in Italy in time for a rest day after 5 days of racing. Quite an unusual opening time trial, a prologue time trial, 5.2 kilometres, two-man time trial, which Eddy Merckx won with his Molteni teammate Roger Swerts. And, well, Merckx took the pink jersey on the first day and didn't relinquish it at all. The first man to wear the pink jersey from start to finish, the other one we'll be featuring in a later episode of our Giro, Gianni Bugno, in 1990. Two other men had led the Giro from start to finish, but that was in the days before the pink jersey was introduced. They were Girardengo in 1919 and Alfredo Binda in 1927. But of course, the Giro was also a good deal shorter then. So Merckx's domination was complete, really, from start to finish. And the other thing that's notable is just how well the Belgians did. They won 13 of the 21 stages. It was a real near dominance by the Belgians.
You mentioned foreign starts there, Lionel, and it was something that Torriani liked to do. A few days ago, well, I was reading a book by a guy called a gentleman called Cesare Sangalli, who was the cartographer for the Giro for I think about 50 years. Anyway, I spoke to him last week actually, but he's an old man now. He's in his 90s and going to do an interview, but he wasn't really well enough last week. In his book, he talks about these grandi partenze that there were lots of very ambitious and one might say slightly harebrained plans that Torriani had with the Giro over the course of his sort of custodianship of the race. And one of the more intriguing ones that I read about in Sangalli's book actually was in the 60s. He wanted to do a tour of the ports of Italy, and he wanted every stage to finish in a port, and he wanted everyone on the race caravan to sleep in a big cruise ship. And the only reason it didn't happen was that the cruise ship was going to be too expensive to hire.
Takes us back to the Mega Smeralda in Corsica in 2013, doesn't it, Daniel? But Torriani, I mean, we covered 2 days ago the Giro of Rebirth in 46, and part of the rebirth was that was Torriani's first at the helm, wasn't it? And he was quite instrumental in restarting and rebooting the Giro, and would remain. I mean, we're very familiar with the Tour de France directors and their Henri Desgrange, Jacques Godet, Jean-Marie Leblanc, Félix Levitin. You know, they're all very well known and close identified figures with their races. But Torriani is equal to any of them, isn't he? Really, 46 years running the race. And in that film that I mentioned, The Greatest Show on Earth, there's an incredible sequence with him. There's an interview with him, but also a sequence set to quite dramatic classical music where he is barking orders at people, manhandling them, clearing them out of the way. It leaves an impression of somebody who was not to be messed with at all.
Well, very quick story, not about the Giro, but about the Tour of Lombardy, when Sean Kelly, I think, was going for three in a row. It was the year that Baron Kelly won, Giambattista Baron Kelly. And clearly Torriani wanted Baron Kelly to win because on one of the climbs, Torriani's race director's car accidentally, on purpose, bumped into Sean Kelly's back wheel and knocked him off. And he took that as a message to perhaps strike a deal with Baron Kelly to get the race result to go a different way.
Well, listen, should we wrap things up? As we mentioned, you can watch Stars and Water Carriers. Recommend that you do. All the details and links are in the episode notes.
How's that wine going down, Rich?
Oh, it went down very well, Daniel. I mean, I might move on to my birthday Lagavulin in a minute. Gift from you chaps for my birthday last week. Thank you very much for that. Still here in my office. But no, I'm not going to do that.
And tomorrow's stage? Well, we're flying back to Italy tonight.
We are.
We're flying to Sicily. And then tomorrow we'll be talking Mafia, one of Napalm's favourite subjects.
Looking forward to it. don't worry, Lionel, you're safe in Watford.
He's slightly traumatised.
That's all for tonight anyway. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, chaps.